You are listening to John Diard's Life Spa, your premier source for health news and Ayurveda, where modern science meets ancient wisdom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. John Diard, and welcome to the Life Spa podcast, where we prove the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with modern science. And today we're going to talk about everything brainwaves, everything stress, everything biofeedback, how you can actually kind of train your brain to handle stress from a calm place, and then take that calm with you into your activity. So instead of doing the same dumb stuff again and again and again in your life, instead of dealing with the same stressors in a way that doesn't serve you again and again and again in your life, there actually is technology that we're going to talk about today that actually can train your brain to create a level of composure and calm. I love to call that the eye of the storm, and slowly teach you how to build the winds around that calm. So ultimately, you can all become a fully mature hurricane with the ability to be incredibly dynamically active in your life, handle the stress of the world, but hailing from an internal state of peace and calm. So our special guest is a former psychotherapist, now neuroscientist, co-founder of a company called Muse, which is the brain sensing headband. Her name is Ariel Garten. She has done research upon research upon research on brainwave patterning, mind, body health, biofeedback. And she's here to talk to us about how the brain works so you can understand, you know, the different stages of what's happening in your brain while you're sleeping. And when you're not sleeping well, what's really happening, and how we can use tools and technology to actually bring your brain back into a state of calm for the deepest level of sleep and REM sleep, as well as the best function of your brain in activity, which is really the best part. We want to kind of train the brain during its restful stages to be incredibly functional when we're actually in the world doing our thing. So, Ariel, welcome. So great to have you here. You know, recently I wrote an article about the epidemic of metabolic syndrome. I mean, it seems like almost every one of my patients has high cholesterol or high blood pressure or high blood sugar or pre-diabetic or extra weight gain. And it's just the epidemic of our time. And so many of those folks, they're already eating a really healthy diet. You know, people don't come to the Ayurvedic guy first. You know, they've gone everywhere else. They come to me, they've tried everything, and then they try to understand maybe in some deeper alternative way what's really going on. And what's really interesting is that when you look at the science of all these conditions, there's, you can say diet will work and exercise work and not smoking work and all these things, but the elephant in the room, the one thing that actually addresses every one of those is the stress that is kind of just in our lives and we can't get rid of it. It's like a rev that we're running faster than we have ever run before in an evolutionary sense. And I really think that that's the thing that we have to address. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to you, because this is your world of understanding stress from the top down, how to mitigate it, you know, from the brain waves, how they can actually tell the whole nervous system, cell by cell, the war's over. So, you know, let's talk about brainwaves and biofeedback and stress and what you do, to give us a little rundown of your background and how you got into this whole thing. I know you're a former psychologist and neuroscience. That's a really cool combination. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Awesome. Thanks, John. So I started working in research labs, really looking at molecular underpinnings of neuroscience. And when I graduated from University of Neuroscience, I then went on to become trained as a psychotherapist because I wanted to actually practically apply it. So, you know, I worked with rats, I worked with models in a dish, and you could understand mechanisms from that way, but it was all sort of meaningless if you weren't applying it to humans. And humans are not simply mechanisms, we're also beings that think and feel and can change our minds or can be very bad at changing our minds. And so I trained as a psychotherapist and was a practicing therapist for a decade. And then along the way started building Muse, a tool to help you understand and improve your brain and how it works.
So let's talk about brainwaves for a second. Most folks have heard about them, and they maybe know that there's good brainwaves and bad brainwaves, and if they're faster ones and slower ones. Can you give us a little rundown on what brainwaves are good, what brainwaves are bad, and how do you get the good ones?
Awesome. So let's start with what is a brainwave? So our brains are filled with neurons. Those are the cells of our brain. And our neurons communicate to one another electrochemically. So they send chemical signals back and forth that actually carry electrical charges. So every time a neuron fires and communicates to the next one, you get a little electrical charge, positive or negative. Our brain waves are the sum total of the electrical activity of our brain as read from outside the head. So you can put basically a penny to your forehead, a conductive piece of metal, and with very, 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 very sensitive equipment, be able to detect the subtle changes in the electrical activity of your brain. Now, from this activity, we can't see much detail. This is really the sum total. It's the general kind of gestalt of what's going on in your brain. But what we can see is changes in state. And we tend to have, as humans, a range of brain waves down from kind of 1.5 hertz up to 30 hertz or more, depending on who you ask. And they reflect the state that we're in. You've probably heard of alpha waves, beta waves. Well, I'm going to explain to you what they mean. So the slowest brain waves that we're in are delta waves. And those are when we are in deep sleep. That is our slow wave sleep. It's like one big pulsing slow wave throughout your whole brain. When we are in a state that's a little bit more dreamlike, it could be referred to as a flow state, it's mind wandering, we're not fully present, we increase that brain activity up to a higher level called theta waves. So theta waves occur when you're awake, but in flow, creative, daydreaming, etc. Alpha waves are one level higher than that, and they happen just before you fall asleep. So when you close your eyes and you're lying in bed, you're completely calm, you're really focused, if you're really gonna fall asleep, you're in one beautiful internal state, and that is alpha waves. Now when you get it, what?
No, you're good, keep going, this is great.
Awesome. So when we meditate, we're actually increasing our alpha wave activity and our theta wave activity. And in alpha waves, you have a state where the frequency is 8 to 12 hertz, depending on how quickly your brain is working. And it's, again, a state where your brain, if you have a high, strong alpha wave, your brain is kind of organized nicely in this alpha rhythm. When we move up, we get beta. And beta is typically from 14 up to 22 hertz. And that's when you are thinking, processing, actively using your brain. You're really engaged in your topic and you're quickly thinking. And then when you're in high beta, which some people define as 22, 25 or higher, then you are often in a state characterized by anxiety. So you have lots of thoughts, you're ruminating, you're anxious. And then there's beyond that gamma wave activity, whose specific reason for being, raison d'etre in the brain, has not totally been defined yet by science. So there's lots of different thoughts about what gamma waves do. But for the most part, science tends to think about, in the human context, closer from delta up to high beta. And gamma waves, we tend to say occur at 40 hertz, some say even higher.
So I've heard that gamma waves have been shown to, like in mice, break up plaque in the brain. I've also read that they can be used for higher states of consciousness and altruism and these kind of things. Is that all speculative?
Okay, so let me talk about the breaking up of amyloid plaques. I work with a lot of neuroscience researchers, and we've actually lately been discussing this. I was just on a call with somebody from Beth Israel Deaconess, and we're like, is this a real phenomenon or not? So the idea is that a 40 hertz rhythm can flush beta amyloid plaques from the brain. And so it's now thought that gamma wave activity can in part potentially decrease the potential for Alzheimer's because you're flushing amyloid out of the brain. So you're not breaking it up, you're flushing it. And how this potentially works is there's friends of mine, Ed Boyden at MIT and a few other researchers there, and Rudy Tanzi, this has been his work for a long time, have created a system of sound and light therapy. I'm sure lots of people here are familiar with sound and light therapy. You have lights flashing in your eyes and sound in your ears, and that actually entrains your brain waves. And their research has begun to show that when you entrain your brain waves at 40 hertz, but it has to be with simultaneous sound and light, you get like this kind of plunging action going on in your glymph nodes. So glymph is kind of like lymph in the body. You've got glymph in the brain. It's part of the drainage system of the brain. And the theory is that when it's stimulated at 40 hertz, there tends to be like this plunger action that might stimulate the movement of beta amyloid to be flushed out of the brain. So that's the theory there. It hasn't fully been proven out in humans. It's been demonstrated in mice, and you know, jury's out, but it looks compelling.
You know, I think it must have been 10 years ago when I first read The Science on Mice, and I bought one of those little gamma like flashing strobe light things, and I would put it on my desk, but it was really annoying. I mean, you're just talking about 40, basically 40 cycles per second going into your eyes like a strobe light. And I was like, and I sent one to my mom, and she goes, "This can't be good. You know, like, it's so annoying, you know." But I love the fact that it's the combination of the light and the sound that actually activates the glymphatic system, which is a huge thing in our world in Ayurveda, because they talk about lymph as the first system we address to treat the body, how well the body gets the trash out. And of course, the glymphatic system is a huge piece of that puzzle. Was there any, before we leave gamma, is there any science about gamma being sort of a higher state of conscious brainwave pattern where you're actually, more altruistic, that kind of thing?
So I haven't heard about the link to altruism, but there is some research that shows monks potentially being in states of gamma when they are meditating. Monks, however, are in various states when they meditate. We've actually done research with monks' brains through our partners. And there's a number of monks that actually are currently using Muse for their own experiments, which is very cool.
Very cool.
This idea of gamma and consciousness, there was a body of thought up until recently that thought about gamma as the sort of binding signal in the brain that brought everything into conscious perception. So as thinking, feeling beings, we basically have a bunch of input that comes into our orifices, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouth, our sensation at once. And it's the brain's job to synthesize all of that into moment by moment awareness, you know, appreciation of this experience as it binds together, and that we call consciousness. And so there's been a theory for a while called the binding theory of consciousness that suggests that there is something that globally connects and brings all of these percepts, your sound, your vision, your thoughts, all of these things into a gestalt and experience at once. And it was thought to potentially be gamma. So that was a theory. That theory has now been left aside for other more popular common theories, like consciousness research theories. But that's part of where the idea of gamma being related to consciousness comes in.
So what you're talking about, where everything comes into one, is that the same as like brainwave coherence, which I know is when all the different parts of the brain are sort of doing the same thing, like all in alpha or all in beta? That's coherence, right? That's different than what you're talking about, right?
That's different than what I'm talking about. But the idea of, okay, so this is getting a little esoteric. So the idea of coherence is that parts of your brain can be synced in some way and share information through that syncing. And the best example of it actually comes from deep sleep. So when you're in deep sleep, you have a very prominent delta wave. And actually, the greater your delta waves, the deeper your sleep is. And it is thought, again, you know, nobody's quite sure about all these things. These are theories, but it is thought that the delta wave that kind of encompasses your whole brain is something that then allows disparate regions of the brain to sync together and share information to, you know, reconnect, to lower their activation state, to transfer to one another, to check in. So the idea that your brain is all moving in the same rhythm suggests that there is a synchrony that goes on, which we know sleep is really helpful and really restorative. So it seems that that is a good thing.
So I'm sort of a little bit of a brainwave, not expert, but a brainwave nerd about this. I'm so excited to talk to you about this because you obviously know everything. I mean, you really know what you're talking about, which is no, you really do. So what I'm hearing you say is that, let's say I'm in delta, I'm in deep sleep. During brainwave coherence, which means all parts of my brain are now in delta, that means that deep rejuvenation of deep sleep is actually affecting my entire brain. So it's like a total brain rejuvenative stage. If I was in alpha and I had brainwave coherence in alpha, then I'm in sort of a meditative state where my mind is sort of restfully alert. I'm alert but calm at the same time, but I'm getting that benefit of that sort of meditative state in all aspects of my experience of my brain. I always thought beta was bad, but you're just saying beta is just thinking. It's not bad, good or bad. I guess it can get bad if it gets to high beta, where you have a lot of too much. The brain is just going way too fast and increase the level of anxiety. But when you're really thinking in beta and all the parts of the brain are firing together, you're probably smarter, right? I would think. Does that all make sense? Is that accurate?
I would say that's 90% accurate. So generally, yes, totally correct. Delta, you've got all the brain doing at once. When you move up into alpha, you do have more of your brain in alpha, but this is still an awake brain. So we know in a sleep brain, we have no other sensory input. The brain's just doing its own thing. It can be internally self-consistent. When we're not deep asleep, when we're in alpha or any other state, we have lots of local field potentials going on at any time. So, you know, your thalamus is moving in its own rhythm, your hypothalamus is moving in its own rhythm. You have lots of little brainwave communications. So you're never always in alpha. Look, it's not all your brain.
Right.
But you are increasing globally more of your brain to be in that state, and more of your brain becomes sort of synced and harmonized, which allows it to, it seems, kind of downregulate and all move in a very pleasant, very in a state that conserves energy for the brain. So it becomes a very restful state.
Right.
And super cool thing about alpha, one way of thinking about it, this is one school of thought. Of course, not many things are totally clear to even scientists yet. One school of thought is alpha is like the refresh rate of your brain. So when your brain is kind of sinking in alpha, that's the rate at which it's taking in its information. And that may be in part why there's a sense of like peace and clarity that comes when like alpha is all syncing together nicely. And as you age, your alpha waves actually decrease. And it's as if the refresh rate on your brain is slowing as you age. So a little bit esoteric, but that's another school of thought. And then you're right about beta. It is neither good nor bad. It's when you're thinking. And thinking is a really good and important thing to do. But if we're always in one gear, in the thinking gear, we don't get this chance to necessarily reintegrate and drop back down into these states that can also be beneficial. If you're sleeping all the time, terrible. If you get the right amount of sleep and it's really good quality sleep, fantastic. You know, then that optimizes you. So throughout your day, you're in a range of different brain states. At any moment, your brain is in a range of different states, but we can start to play with these states to shift our brain for periods of time in ways that are really helpful to it.
You know, back in the early 1990s, did research on nose breathing versus mouth breathing, and we actually published studies in International Journal of Neuroscience on the difference of nose breathing versus mouth breathing. We found that when these high school athletes were breathing through their nose during a submaximal stress, like 200 watts of resistance on an exercise bike, which is pretty, you know, significant, their brain went into an alpha state, and actually somewhat brainwave coherence in alpha. And then when they came back into the exercise with their mouth open, their brain went into beta state, which is a pretty typical. But that was the first time, at least the researchers that I worked with, they said this is the first time anybody's ever actually seen alpha in the brain during vigorous exercise before. I'd love to just hear your take on I was trying to replicate the runner's high or the zone where you're my best race is my easiest race, where you have that sort of coexistence of opposites, where you have a dynamic activity coexisting with a level of composure and calm, And that would be, you know, and we actually saw the alpha was there, which made sense. We also saw the fight or flight and parasympathetic nervous systems. Normally sympathetic goes 100% during exercise, parasympathetic zeroes out. But in our study, the two opposite nervous systems coexisted. So we had the fight or flight system coexisting with the calm rejuvenative system, and the brain was now slipped into a coherent state, more coherent state of alpha. And that was all just from having them just breathe through their nose and do the same workout with their mouth open. I'd just love to hear your take on that, because you know so much about this.
So first of all, that's a super cool study. What year was this?
It was 1992. I can send you the study.
Amazing. Yeah. Wow, you were totally in the vanguard of researching this. That's fantastic. So yes, there's a lot of research on nose breathing versus mouth breathing, as well as alternate nostril breathing, and how alternate nostril breathing can help you either upregulate your energy system and bring more energy to you, or downregulate and create greater calm, depending on whether you're using your left or your right nostril. In terms of the relation to brainwaves, so you're totally right that an optimum state for sports performance is increased alpha activity. And when they do research around, you know, divers the moment before they do their best dive, so anyone who is a very skilled athlete, when they are performing their skill to their top, to the excellence where they make the least mistakes, they're in alpha activity versus beta activity. And that is because it's when the activity has become automated in the brain. So if you're in, you know, high beta when you're about to do your big spin, you know, your big jump off the diving board, A, you're probably really anxious, which is not good. B, you're probably overthinking it. And what you really need to be doing is instead C, which is getting your brain out of the way and letting your body gracefully and easily do that thing that you've practiced 1,000 times over. And the thought is that when we move from an action that we really need to think about to actually becoming an expert at something and having it ingrained in our bodies, like the muscle movement, it just happens beautifully from you. You move from this beta state into the alpha state. And there's been research demonstrating that golfers might have their best swing when they're in alpha, when they do it, as opposed to being in beta, because it's been now not something you're overthinking and worrying about, but something you simply cleanly and beautifully follow through with ease and focus.
So to nerd out on this a little bit more, when you actually breathe through the nose and you use Ujjayi pranayama, which creates an abdominal contraction where you constrict the back of your throat, you create an abdominal diaphragmatic cardiac massage, which activates the vagus nerve, which activates, tells the body the war is over, and we can slip into this sort of, more likely slip into this sort of non-thinking doing state. So when you're actually hitting a golf ball, I work with, Billie Jean King did the foreword to my book, so did Martina Navratilova. I wrote a book about this years ago. And they were all about the idea that when you're actually hitting the ball, whether with a golf ball or a tennis ball, that during that point, if you're breathing out through your nose and creating that abdominal diaphragmatic cardiac massage, the brain slips into an alpha state. And during impact, you're not thinking, you're doing. It's like cutting, you know, chopping a piece of wood with your karate, and that kia, you know, and that kia creates that same effect, and you get a burst of alpha during impact. You know, there was a book that was written called the Return of Superman. I don't know if you saw it. It was about 10 years ago, maybe, and it was about these extreme athletes. I mean, and what their brainwaves were doing when they were in that extreme state, like you said. Like, there was one guy who wanted to skateboard jump over the Great Wall of China, you know, which, like, jump over the whole wall. He did it the first time, crashed and burned. His ankle was swollen like this, you know, the next day, wraps his ankle and goes and does it again. These are these extreme athletes, right? And he goes and he does it and he nails it on an ankle that was so broken that he just did it. But, and what was so funny about these extreme athletes, because they're reaching for that place when they're doing this extreme thing, their brain slips into this alpha state. And I was like, you know, there's a better way to do that. All you got to do is close your mouth and breathe through your nose. You don't have to risk your entire life, because most of these guys at the end of their career are broken significantly or so depressed because they can't continue to get that same adrenaline / alpha brainwave effect because their body won't let them do those extreme things anymore. So most of them at the end of this book were either dead or severely broken. I was like, oh, you know, we have research here that shows all you gotta do is breathe through your nose, you get that same state and you can live a healthy, long life, you know? But anyway, Thanks for commenting on that. I think that's really, really cool. Getting back to brainwave coherence, I'm imagining that one of the things that you can measure would be the ability to go into like a, one of these brainwaves, say like alpha, and then can you also measure, is it a good thing for that all the different parts of the brain to be in alpha, where you get the sort of the most rejuvenative experience of alpha or theta or delta? And is that something you guys can measure?
You mean with Muse?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Well, should we explain what Muse is and how it works?
That would be good. Let's do that first.
Awesome. So Muse is a brainwave sensing headband. It is a clinical grade EEG, a device that tracks your brain with sensors on the forehead and behind the ears. And so we're able to track your brainwaves and then give you real-time neurofeedback, so feedback to your brain to let you know which brainwave state you're in and to keep you in the desired state. And we do that a few ways. And the most, one of the most compelling ones is through a meditation practice where you focus your attention on your breath. And when the system detects that you are in a state of calm, focused attention on your breath, predominantly in alpha, we give you beautiful little audio cues that encourage you to keep going. So yes, we totally measure when you are in alpha and we reinforce the brain for staying there. And I'm going to grab a Muse so you can see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, be good. I know like when I did, we did our research for folks to know you would actually put on a whole cap and you'd have to kind of a little, there were little holes in the cap and you'd have to like drill through your hair with acid to literally create a clear, right? You had to get like a really clean connection. So you had to like, you had these little burn holes all over your head.
We don't do any of that. So
it's way better now. Yeah.
The states of the arts moved really far forward. So we've spent, Muse has been in market since 2014. So we've spent a very long time prior to that. And then a decade since then perfecting this device, which gives you clinical grade EEG, dry sensor. So no gel, no goo, no nothing. It just slips on your head behind your ears and then you tighten it up. And then you can track your brainwave activity right on your smartphone with the Muse app.
And that is this the one that you would sleep with or just as a meditation one?
So yeah, we have two different versions. This is the Muse 2, and this one does real-time feedback during meditation in many different forms. And then This is the new one that you sleep with, and it also has sensors on the forehead and behind the ears. Both EEG as well as a range of other sensors. And this one tracks sleep literally as effectively as a sleep lab and comes with all of the meditation tools as well as guidance to help you fall asleep and stay asleep.
So you would have kind of this, you'd be listening to this like music or a track or what meditation kind of sound, and you would be sleeping the entire night or is it an hour? Or how does that work?
So you can either just wear the Muse as you're falling asleep, or you can wear it throughout the night. And what it does is it gives you audio cues to guide your brain into sleep. So we have a system that's actually tracking your wakefulness as you go from wakefulness into sleep, as you move through alpha into N1, the beginning of sleep state, and when you drop into delta. And we're able to, throughout those stages, actually give you audio cues based on where your brain is at that walk your brain into sleep. So you're listening to audio and the audio starts to shift and change based on your brain state in a way that guides your brain to sleep. And then if you wear the Muse throughout the night and you wake up in the middle of the night, it gives you a few minutes to fall asleep on your own and then brings back in the same beautiful experience that helped you fall asleep the first time to help you fall back asleep.
So this is not only something you would wear to help become a better meditator. This is actually something that can actually kind of nudge and sort of direct your brain into the REM sleep and the deep sleep that many of us aren't getting enough of. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So what it really does right now is it nudges your brain into N1. So the beginning of sleep. So for those
what is N1?
N1 is the first stage of sleep. So you have wakefulness, then you close your eyes, your alpha waves increase, but you're still awake. And as you move into N1, that is the first stage of sleep. It's called light sleep, and it's the hypnagogic state. And that's where you have all the sort of like imagery. If somebody wakes you up, then you think you've been awake, but you aren't. You're the beginning of sleep. And we give you audio cues that transition you from N1 into N2, and then down into deep sleep. So the audio cues help you move through the wake to sleep transition to help you both fall asleep and then fall back asleep if you wake up again. And then we work with lots of researchers. So there's dozens and dozens of sleep researchers around the world that use Muse actually as an at-home sleep research tool instead of sending people to a sleep lab. And with them, we're innovating things like deep sleep stimulation. So you can play an audio tone during the upswing of the delta wave. And when you do that, it enhances the amplitude, the amount of power in each of your delta waves, which can give you deeper sleep. So that feature is not out yet. That's still a research feature. But when you get the Muse, as we keep building all these features, you get them all as they arrive.
So that you get upgrade your
Yeah, the software
every.
continues to upgrade as our technology does.
Wow. So is there an individual variability there where some people need this sound cue and some people need this, or how does it work? Because everybody seems to be so different.
Everybody's totally so different. So we have dozens of different types of guided audios that you choose from. So some people might like listening to a story as they fall asleep, so their mind is engaged and they're off their problems, but they're listening to something that's keeping them engaged. Some people like to just listen to white noise or thunderstorm, other people to music. And then we also have a range of guided meditations for what might be troubling you. I'm having difficulty falling asleep because I had a fight with my husband. It's like, we've got one for anger. We've got one for stress. Guided meditations that help you calm your nervous system and your mind to help you guide through that transition. And then the audio, is modulated based on your brain state. So for everybody, it's a little bit different.
Wow, so how many different programs are there that you could choose from?
So for all of the neurofeedback experiences that we have lots of different choices. So for Muse Mind, back to the meditation. So we have several different meditation types that you use with Muse. We have meditation for the mind, where you're listening to your brain and focused attention and being guided there. We have meditation for the heart, and there you're listening to your heart like the beating of a drum, and that tunes your interoception, your ability to sensitively understand your internal state. We have breath meditation that guide you through different breathing exercises like box breathing, resonant breathing. So we're tracking your brain and letting you know how close you're doing and keeping to the guide. We have stillness meditation, just helping you find stillness in your body. And for each of those, we have lots and lots of different soundscapes and experiences within them. And then in the go to sleep experiences, we have soundscapes, we have journeys that things like underwater adventure, walk in the forest. We have meditations. There's like, if there's one problem with our app, it's that there's way too many options.
Wow. So in all those are you've done studies on like the heart meditation and the effect on what's happening when you do that particular meditation. So all these are scientifically documented. You reference them and all
Okay, so there's been over 200
that.
papers published with Muse. It's used in literally thousands of research laboratories. And so, like heart meditation specifically, there hasn't been a paper on the heart meditation. But for example, Mayo Clinic uses Muse interventionally, and they say, okay, go and use any part of the Muse app that you like for 10 minutes a day over 3 months. And the first study that they did was with women with breast cancer, and using Muse as a meditation tool decreased the stress and fatigue and improved quality of life in the cancer care process. They then went on to fibromyalgia, Cushing's syndrome. They have a menopause study, and in each of these cases, seeing significant impact, like in Cushing's syndrome, actually seeing changes in endocrine levels through using Muse for 3 months. And the most recent study that was just published like a day ago was a long COVID study. So Mayo Clinic had 44 participants with long COVID use Muse for 3 months. And again, they could use whatever parts of the app they wanted. They had to do mind meditations, the focused attention on the breath, 4 days a week. But other than that, they can free choice. And they significantly improved their long COVID symptoms, decreased anxiety, decreased stress, and improved cognitive function. And so Mayo Clinic actually now includes it as part of its long COVID recommendation protocol.
Wow. Early on, there were a bunch of studies on long COVID being linked to the congestion of the brain, lymph, and glymphatic systems. And I wonder if you have a mechanism for what you just described. Like, how to, is it the glymph in the brain that's actually draining now, finally, which obviously carries the immune system and that could be a factor? Was it just the change of the brain waves? Do you have any radar on what actually was the underlying mechanism for that? Or was it, yeah.
We don't yet know the mechanism. So, I
Okay.
mean, there's theories. One is decreased activity of the sympathetic and increased parasympathetic downregulates the immune system response through your body's immune fighters. But we don't actually know overall why it was so efficacious. So far, we
Right.
just know it works. And so there'll be more studies to actually tease out, what are the pieces? But we know it's effective.
But you definitely know that when you listen to these programs on the app, they absolutely have a documented effect on changing your brain waves for the better.
Yes.
Is it different than, most people, a lot of people either wear, an Apple Watch or a Oura Ring, and they're looking at how much deep sleep and how much REM sleep they get every night. Is there a specific amount of deep and REM you should get? And it sounds like you go way beyond just the simplicity of I have, an hour and a half of REM and an hour and a half of deep. And, is there a number that you would kind of shoot for? And how do you guys take that even further?
So, in classical sleep science, we say that you probably want about 8 hours of sleep. It varies, some people seven, some people eight. Of that, half of it is going to be deep sleep. So, the first half of your night is going to be where your deep sleep occurs. And you're probably going to get 2 hours of deep sleep in that if you're doing perfect textbook extraordinary. And the second half of your night is where you have more REM sleep, and you're looking for about half of that period to be in REM sleep, probably a little more. Most people err on a little less deep sleep and a little bit more REM sleep than kind of the half and half rule. But it's quite cool that our brains really do go through this cycle where the majority of your deep sleep is happening right at the beginning in the first 4 hours of sleep. And so, REM sleep, which is just as important, even though we say, like, oh, deep sleep is king, REM sleep's also important. REM sleep happens in the second half. So if you're somebody who, chooses not to sleep for an hour and a half because you're waking up early, because you want to do something, you might be either shirking your deep sleep or shirking your REM sleep. In terms of Muse, what we're able to show you is not just how much deep sleep and how much REM sleep, but actually the depth of your deep sleep. So we show you the total amplitude of your delta waves. So you see not just how long you were in the state, but the quality of your deep sleep and how deep it was.
Oh wow, beautiful. Can you kind of just describe with a little bit more detail what the phases of sleep are and like what's happening in deep sleep, what's happening in REM sleep, so people understand, the whole idea of this whole sleep cycle?
Sure. So sleep really is a cycle. You don't just close your eyes and then nothing happens for 8 hours. You're going through this kind of orchestrated progression that happens in your brain, and what happens in your brain links to what happens in your body throughout the night. So when you first close your eyes, they say it takes a good sleeper 10 minutes or less to fall asleep. So anything more than 20 minutes to fall asleep with your eyes closed, you could probably do some exercises and activities to improve that. Anything less than 5 minutes, wow, you're crisp, incredible at falling asleep. So you close your eyes, you get the alpha block as soon as you close your eyes. As you move into N1, so that's the first stage of sleep, light sleep, you're in the hypnagogic state. And there, everything's like a little kind of dreamy. And then you move quite quickly from that into N2 sleep and into deep sleep. And Usually at the beginning of the night, you have cycles with more deep sleep. So you'll go deep sleep. You might spike up into N2, maybe a little wakefulness back into N2, deep sleep, wakefulness, a little REM, deep sleep. And then the second half of your night, you've got a little deep sleep, and then you're into REM, and then a little bit of N2, and then you're into REM. And so your brain's actually working in cycles, and each piece of this cycle has a different purpose. So in deep sleep, your glymph systems are more active. So the very first study we talked about flushing amyloid from the brain, it turns out that yes, 40 hertz might be powerful for it, but deep sleep is also really powerful for it because deep sleep is when our glymph systems are the most active. And there's a link between sleep quality and the potential for the impact of Alzheimer's, for example, because of the action of our brain being rinsed out and amyloid moving through during deep sleep. REM sleep is also incredibly important. So there's various memory functions that go on throughout the night, some of them attributed to deep sleep, some of them attributed to REM sleep. So one of the things that we do in deep sleep is we consolidate our memories. And it's kind of like in deep sleep, you're going through the file system. So you learn some stuff through the day. And in deep sleep, your brain's going through the file system, pulling out information you might already know, and attaching what you learned during the day to that information and consolidating those memories and making more connections around them. And there's also the process in sleep, which is really cool, of active forgetting. So we're not only choosing what to remember, we're also choosing what to forget. So things like, where you parked, you go to the same parking lot every day, where you parked that day is something that your brain might say, like, we don't need to know that anymore. It was yesterday. There'll be a new spot tomorrow. And frankly, we don't want to remember yesterday's spot while we're looking for tomorrow's spot. So your brain both remembers and forgets. And then REM has a different quality of memory experience. Again, the stuff is coming out, new connections are being made. We know that because we have all these funny images that happen during REM sleep. That's when we dream. But it's thought that those connections that happen are more emotional. So your emotional circuits start to become activated and you replay different emotional experiences and fire them through your brain throughout the REM sleep. And while your brain is doing this, your body is also restoring and repairing. So it has less digestive load upon it. It has less cardiovascular load upon it. So all the energy that you spend throughout the day trying to move your muscles and work them and digest things throughout the night, your body can spend repairing, restoring, and putting that energy into a place of really returning your body to its optimum condition for the next morning.
Wow. So in deep sleep, that's where the glymphatic system is activated. Now, they only recently discovered the glymphatic system. What did they think deep sleep did, or what does it do in addition to help, draining the glymph and lymphatic systems in the brain?
So the prime thing that we believe it does is memory consolidation. So,
Okay.
and in fact, if you disrupt, okay, so getting a little bit deeper, there are these cool things called sleep spindles. So as you're falling asleep, you're moving from alpha, you're 10 hertz, let's call it an alpha. As you're going into deep sleep, you're going to be down at 1.5 hertz, but it's not a smooth transition. Your brain goes with two things. One is sleep spindles, which are spiky bursts of activity at 13 to 15 hertz, and the other is K complexes, which are these huge, big, slow wave spikes. So the role of K complexes is to actually sort of blunt all of your sensory systems so you stay in deep sleep. So you get this huge spike, which is almost effectively like flooding your audio, your visual, your olfactory, all of it, and saying, "Don't work right now. We're in deep sleep. Like, don't bother us." So it's coordinating this lack of consciousness. These are the K complexes, and the higher and bigger your K complex, the deeper you're going to sleep. And that's when people are like sleeping really soundly, sleeping like a log. You couldn't wake them. That's because they're in deep sleep. And the bigger the K complex, the more you're able to re remain in that state. And the sleep spindles happen at N2 state sleep, the second stage of sleep. And they're thought to be most closely tied to memory consolidation. And if you block sleep spindle activity, you can block learning consolidation the next day. So, you learn something today, and then if you block your sleep spindles, you're less likely to know it the next day. And we actually do cool research with our research partners where we look at things like targeted memory reactivation, where you play a tone or a sound during daytime, while learning, and then you replay that tone during sleep spindles, and then you see the outcome the next day to see if there's more learning. Those experiments are like, just in the ground stages, so we don't have results from them yet. But this is the kind of cool stuff that will be happening in the future as we start to really understand sleep and how we can enhance the different phases of it and therefore improve the outcomes in our lives.
Wow, amazing. And is it the REM sleep that you're sort of paralyzed and you can't kind of move? Is that when that's
Totally.
happening?
Yeah, so in REM sleep, your brainstem kind of gets cut out of the equation, and your body is paralyzed. And so when you otherwise, you would be acting out your dreams. And there's actually disorders, one called REM sleep behavioral disorder, which is when your body does not become paralyzed during sleep. And some people, act and flail because you've got these profound images happening in your mind, but your body's acting them out. And there's other things like parasomnambulisms, like when you're sleepwalking, when that paralysis is not happening effectively. So, yes, we're totally paralyzed during some stages of sleep, and that's actually a good thing.
Is it bad? Is it bad when you sleepwalk? Is that a bad thing?
I don't know that there's, the dangers associated with it. But is it particularly bad? Who's to judge? Who's to say what's good or bad?
Is it common? People sleepwalking?
Oh, I don't know the percentage of it happening in the population.
Yeah.
But another
Kids seem to do it more. Kids seem to do it more than, and then they sort of seem to grow out of it. True. We have six kids and you would see them once in a while walking through the halls in the middle of the night.
Amazing. I wanted to touch
Go
for a
ahead.
second on another phenomenon, lucid dreaming.
Yeah.
So we work with a professor at Northwestern University, Ken Paller, and he's an expert in lucid dreaming and also in wisdom traditions. And he has created this system that we're implementing with Muse to alert you when you're in REM state to teach you to lucid dream. So how you want to lucid dream is when you're in REM state, when you're in your dream, you hear a tone or a sound that then awakens you, like lets you know. You can, in one study that we actually have currently with IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, they use Muse to track people while they were lucid dreaming. And they gave a little sign, their eyes moving left and right, that they were in lucid dream. And the people at IONS were actually able to see that signal in the Muse EEG to say, like, yes, they were lucid dreaming. They got to the state and they signaled it back. And so the idea with lucid dreaming is that you can actually be awake in your dream and have control over your dream life, and in doing so, potentially work out some of the psychotherapeutic stuff that lives in our subconscious mind.
That's a very Vedic concept, the idea of being, the whole idea of coexistence of opposites, where you're dynamically active and completely resting at the same time. One of the Vedas is called Dhanurved, like the Dhanurasana, the bow asana, and it was the Veda of the warriors, and they were, these sort of ninja type people where they had the ability to be completely relaxed. They were resting, but they were completely wide awake, so they could never be, surprised with someone, and they had that incredible ability to be, alert and resting at the same time. So they didn't need to go into deep resting sleep and get conked out to get rejuvenated. They were able to get that rejuvenation in sort of a lucid state where they were sort of aware and resting at the same time. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's one of the ways that we describe meditation. So there's lots of ways to think about meditation, and one is along this axis of laxity versus clarity. So we know in meditation we want to be calm, but you can be calm and like zoned out, or you can be calm and absolutely clued in. So are you in the space of laxity, in which case you're not really engaged, or are you in the space of clarity, in which you're seeing clearly or clear your engagement? And so in meditation, it is really a state of incredibly beautifully focused, so you are present, your mind is not lax, but it's also relaxed, so it is at peace and at ease. So that state actually makes perfect sense to me.
Wow, beautiful. Can you use the muse to, like, let's say you're a golfer, can you use the muse to take your golf swing and see, if your brain went into alpha or some kind of coherence during impact or during a swing? Is that something you could use it, that kind of research?
So there's actually, if you have a muse, you can then access programs by a number of different scientists and coaches that have been built for it. So there's one program called OptiBrain, and it's made specifically for golfers. And it shows you your brain during the swing. It teaches you how to train for the ultimate swing. So that when you have a muse, you then have access to, all of these other programs that you can join. Not made by us, but by other awesome people building cool things.
And that's in your app. You can kind of
That
download that.
that's not in our app, but you can find it once you have your Muse. You can find it in the App Store, and it's called OptiBrain.
Oh, I see. I see. So you could look at your brainwave during impact or playing tennis or whatever. You could wear it during those things. That's crazy. That's amazing. I think a lot of people would, who are golfers or the tennis players or the pickleball players or whatever, would love to kind of see, because it's, I think everybody who plays sports knows that when you're playing by yourself, you're in that non-thinking state a lot easier. But when the point matters and you're stressed out, you freeze up, and that freezing up is something that be neat if you could train your brain to not do that. I would imagine that the idea of using the muse would give you kind of training tools to get to a place where in the stress of life that you don't freeze up and go into a beta activity. You could stay more kind of non-thinking or alpha-based during activity. Is that true?
That's exactly it. So it trains you to be able to observe your own mind. So, as a meditator, that's part of your role. You're observing your consciousness, you're observing your mind, you're observing your thoughts. And so Muse trains you to observe your brain and then to be able to make choices about what happens in it. So you could have a thought come up that's very problematic and gets you anxious. And at that point, you have the choice to say, I'm going to dive into this thought and make myself anxious, or I'm going to do what I learned in Muse, which is just stay focused on the thing in front of me, let the thought move by, and consciously choose the, restful, focused clarity that I choose to stay in. So it really trains you how to then take the act of meditating, into your daily life and to be able to stay there. And there's was actually a super cool study by the Catholic University of Milan, and they had people meditate with Muse and without Muse, for 10 minutes a day. By the end of the study, 1 month later, it was up to 20 minutes a day, and they demonstrated that both with and without Muse meditation, people improved in markers like stress, anxiety, but those who meditated with Muse actually had a persistent change in their alpha activity. So throughout the day, not just when they were using the device, but throughout the day, they had increased alpha activity through their daily life.
Wow, seriously, that's crazy. That's, in Ayurveda, there's a statement. It's called Yogastha Kuru Kamani, which means first, and this is like the premise of all the Vedic literature, yoga, breathing, meditation. It means first you establish being and then perform action. That's the whole point. And a lot of us, do the yoga, breathing, meditate, and then we go off the mat and then go sort of lie, cheat, steal, get stressed out, and it doesn't seem to translate into our activity in our life. Where what you're talking about is literally taking it off the mat, literally learning how to have, door number one, which is our stress way of living life, going down, doing the same dumb stuff again and again in our life, and then training your brain to actually see that there is a door number two, and it's a way that allows me to not. To engage in more, like you said, introspective, which means interoception, which means that I'm actually, letting a more authentic version of me out. I'm not just engaging in behavior based on patterns of stress and patterns of mitigating stress and adapting to stress. You're actually letting the body be calm and find a level of peace and let that version of peace and calm out in activity. And what you're telling me is that we can actually train the brain to stop doing door number one, which is going down the same road with four lanes with lights on it that we drive down all the time, stressed out, do the same dumb stuff again and again and again. And now we're all of a sudden going to see inactivity. There's a door number two there. But I don't have to do that same, react to that same situation in the same old way. I can actually choose in real time to go and to do this thing, which allows a more vulnerable, a more delicate, a more beautiful, a more calm, and more powerful version of me to engage in this activity. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes. Yes.
That's crazy. That's really phenomenal. I mean, amazing.
It's something that's available to all of us with or without technology. So, I mean, those two choices are always there. We can all choose to get there. It's just really, really hard. It's really hard to do it on our own. So, you know, it's just a tool that accelerates your training to door number two.
Wow. Amazing. Well, that is such a, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, this is what yoga, breathing, meditation is really about, is taking it off the mat. And that's what when we first did our nose breathing exercise, I was like, hey, if you can handle exercise stress from a calm place, why can't you handle life stress from a calm place? So I used it as a model for handling stress from a calm place, you know, the eye of the storm. And the more you can create the calm, then you can slowly build the winds around that calm, and you can ultimately become a fully mature hurricane with the ability to be dynamically active and calm at the same time. But it's not easy, particularly with all the incoming that we have on this planet, you know, constant stressors, constant worries, this, like we said in the very beginning, this rev of constant, you know, information that overstimulates us and has really, in a lot of senses, just evaporated any awareness that there is a level of internal calm, that I can actually go through life in that sort of zone, runner's high, euphoric state where my best race is my easiest race, that I'm going through life in a kind of effortless way, going downstream with the current versus fighting the current every single day. I think it's amazing. Can you show us both of those units, units again, so we get a better sense? And what's the best one for people to get started with? Like, how does that work? What would you suggest?
Sure. So this is the Muse 2. And this is the one that does just meditation. I say just meditation, but that's also a lot. So it has meditation for brain, heart, breath, and body, and guided meditation. So that's this device. And then this one is the Muse S. It's actually our brand new device that launches today. So auspicious day. And this one does all of the meditation stuff as well as sleep. And actually the incredible upgrade that we now have with Athena is we have two new sensors in it. One that tracks your SpO2, your breath. And another one that tracks, it's called FNIRS, frontal near infrared spectroscopy. So we're actually tracking the blood flow to your prefrontal cortex. So you can not only learn to manage and control and understand your brainwave activity, but you can also look at the way the blood perfuses your brain in the prefrontal cortex and train it to upregulate its oxygen demand. Meaning,
so this would be really great for teenagers who haven't quite developed that part of
their prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
Yes, or people as they age on the other side of the spectrum, where the prefrontal cortex then begins to thin and not work as effectively.
Wow. I mean, it's just like exercising your brain, really, is what it's doing. It's keep firing neurons in different parts of your brain, so your brain stays young and youthful and elastic, right? And plastic. So it doesn't become stiff and rigid because you're not using all the parts. Is that accurate?
That's totally accurate. I mean, we can still only get to certain parts. The FNIRS is on the prefrontal cortex. It's not all over your brain, but at least you can, you know, work on that area, and through meditation, work on your whole brain.
Oh my God, that's really crazy. Okay, so tell us the bad news. How much do those cost?
I don't actually know, because that's not what I usually think about.
People can go to your website, right, and figure that out?
Yeah, you can go to our website, choosemuse.com, C-H-O-O-S-E.
Say it again, sorry.
C-H-O-O-S-E-M-U-S-E.com, choosemuse. And so the Muse 2 is around $250, and the Muse S is around, I think, $499.
Okay, so you really, I mean, you don't need both of them. You need either just little one or the big one, right? Yeah. The Athena is the one that's more expensive. And for everybody to know, Ariel has also offered a link. If you use the link when you buy it, Life Spa, you get a 15% discount on the Muses, whatever one that you like to buy. So just know that that's available. Just use the code LifeSpa. This is amazing. I bought a Muse when it first came out, and I wanted to use it for golf and tennis and hitting balls and stuff. And there wasn't the technology to kind of do that thing where now you can. There's apps where you can actually get that, and I used it for a while. But then my kids got a hold of it, and next thing I knew, there's pieces of it here and there, but I think some kids borrowed it and never really got it back. So I never really got a chance to really dive into it. But I also didn't know what I know now from listening to you. You really have enlightened me about, I thought, from a Vedic perspective, we should just meditate and do it without technology. But I have so many patients who don't meditate well, who as a result don't do it because they just don't feel like they're getting any benefit out of their mind is spinning and they can't get that silence. But the idea that you can actually do what we're talking about here today, that you can actually educate your brain to handle stress from a calm place in real time is mind-boggling, because that's, like we said, the cause of all these issues. You go to your doctor and they tell you you have high cholesterol, you need to go on a statin, and you have prediabetes, you need to go on another medication, your blood pressure is high, another medication, you're overweight, another medication. I mean, this is America. And when you look at the science, all of those things are caused by stress. And what you're talking about is actually giving your brain, how many minutes a day, like 20 minutes a day, you can put this thing 10. On? 10. And then you start seeing yourself handling stress from a calm place in real time. And as you age, and you start thinking about brain health as you get older and dementia and cognitive decline as you age. And you're talking about, this is sort of a way of exercising parts of your brain to potentially stave off some of that age-related cognitive decline. Is that accurate as well?
That is accurate. That is what the evidence seems to be pointing towards.
Wow. Crazy. I love it. I'm way into this now. Thank you so much for coming and sharing. Is there anything that you haven't told us that we all need to know about this?
Just that you're all wonderful, whole, capable, full human beings, even if your brain is telling you that you're not. We're all wonderful. I also think it's really cool that your kids stole your meditation tool. I think that was an underappreciated part of the story.
It was a Christmas present that I asked for, and then it disappeared, So, yeah. And when your kids, my kids seem to think everything here is just as much theirs as it is mine. And now I'm getting older, I'm going, no, that's mine. You can't take that. And, it's so funny. I go see my kids, and one of my kids in Oregon, and he's wearing my clothes. I'm going like, I wondered where that went. I love that jacket. But it's all cute, and they do meditate, so that's cool. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. Really wonderful work you're doing with this, and I love the fact that it's been evolving since 2014. It's been a long time. How many upgrades have happened to the software in all these years?
So the software upgrades continuously. We have a new release every single month. Hardware, we've had the original Muse. I still meet people with the original Muse that use it. The first Muse 2, then the upgrade to Muse 2. This is the third upgrade to Muse 2, actually. Along the way, we've made a pair of glasses that integrated Muse technology. And then the Muse S generation. This is the Athena is the third generation of the Muse S style. So it's been a lot of upgrades. We continue to innovate.
And that's so neat that the research is still going on. And, I'm sure that this is just going to get better and better and better, right, as the technology and the research comes in.
Yeah, though people still use their original Muse that they bought in 2014. It still works too.
Wow, amazing. Ariel, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And we'll stay in touch. And as this thing develops, we'll have you back.
Wonderful. I look forward to it. It was such a pleasure today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, everybody. I just want to take a minute and tell you what we do here at LifeSpa.com. I've been in practice now for 40 years, 38 of them have been practicing Ayurvedic medicine full time. For the last 20 years, I've been writing articles and doing videos on the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with the modern science. You know, if something's been around for 1,000 years, still practiced today, and you have modern science to prove it, boy, I really feel like that's something we should all be taking a look at. And that's what we do at lifespa.com. And all that information is for free. So just go to lifespa.com and search in your health topic, and you'll get the information, the article that you need, hopefully that will help you. While you're there, check out our Ayurvedic store. You can get there through lifespa.com or go to store.lifespa.com. And there we have all of our organic Ayurvedic herbs, organic skincare line, more books, tapes, knowledge that we give you is all there at our store. All of our cleansing kits are there in our store. All of our herbs are whole herbs with the natural occurring microbiome, the way it came out of the soil. And that's critically important, because if I took the bugs out of you, you'd be completely different. We take the bugs away from a plant, like sterilizing and making an extract or spraying your food with pesticides, you lose significant benefit of that plant. And that's why we use the whole plant with the natural occurring microbiome. So check us out, learn more about what we're doing here at lifespa.com, and we'll see you again.
This recording is brought to you by LifeSpa, where ancient Ayurvedic wisdom meets modern science. Get access to free health video newsletters by Dr. John at lifespa.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.